So earlier today, I was with a yogi. And she was so clear about her aspirations for her practice and her life. It was really powerful to witness. Like, her aspiration, the clarity of it. And her determination to live her aspiration through these very specific intentions, like filled her with a regality. She was so dignified, so, and it came from the inside. It was like a movement from the inside. It was just so powerful to witness and behold. I mean, this intention of hers had always been there, but it just took on a different flavor today. And I think it was because it was wedded to very specific intentions that she was determined to carry out in her life. Was like a part of her was like, I'm done with suffering in that way. It was just such a privilege to see. So I've been thinking about aspirations a lot lately. And then being with her just put it kind of front and center for me. And it's got me thinking about what are some of your aspirations? What is it that your heart longs to live into? What are the aspirations that you have for this practice in your life? We're friends, we're Dharma friends. We've known each other for quite some time. So just feel free to unmute yourselves and you can share a phrase. A word that captures or attempts to capture your aspiration for practice for your life. What is it that you long to live into? Anyone can start. Any brave heart can start.
I like a quiet mind.
Quiet mind. Beautiful.
More patience.
More patience. I have a friend named JMO. We're in the teacher training together, and her J stands for Jessica because that's her first name, and then her last name is Maury. So she just took the J and the first two letters of Maury, MO. But she said it also represented more joy, JMO. More patience, more joy. Yeah, thank you. Quiet mind, more patience.
Contemplating what it means to be kind.
What does
Know,
it mean?
moment by moment, moment by moment.
What does it mean to be kind, moment by moment? Other aspirations.
Been thinking about this kind of a lot, and not to be morbid, but to be ready for death, to be ready to die.
That's not morbid at all. It's coming. And we can prepare for it, right? Yeah, how do we want to die? And so much of how we want to die ends up influencing how we live so that we are ready for that call that comes in that says, you've got about 3 months, Miss Scott. Like, okay, I've been practicing for this. I'm ready. It's not morbid at all. Other things you're longing to live into.
For me, it's kind of an aspiration and intention. And I would say maybe the aspiration is to be available to the Dhamma, and how that becomes more of an intention for me is just that orienting to this moment as a moment of practice.
Beautiful.
I can do that pretty well in the in times on the cushion, on the chair, formal practice, and then off the cushion or non-formal times, then it's more challenging.
That's right. And you want to empathize with what Art's saying? I so do. I so do. Yeah. Easier to do on the cushion. Just gets a little more complex in daily life, right? Making ourselves available to Dhamma. Yeah. Art, you brought in something, the difference between aspiration and intention. And I've been exploring this. I'm just curious what you see as the difference between aspiration and intention.
Yeah, I certainly have been influenced a lot by Philip and his talk around intention and really seeing intention as how you meet this moment, you know,
okay.
Kind of orientation kind of over and over. How do we continually reorient to how we meet this moment? And then, yeah, and then the aspiration is something a little... it can be a little larger or something, or it's not, maybe less, a little bit less of that kind of moment to moment piece or something.
It's like feels like an overall, like, I've been thinking of aspiration in terms of like, where am I headed? Like, and then the moment to moment is like, okay, so, or the intention is the moment-to-moment GPS. Like, how do I get there? Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Thank you.
Sure, absolutely.
Maybe a couple of more reflections on aspirations. What is it that you're longing to live into?
I'm longing to live into gratitude.
Gratitude.
Letting go of the wanting mind. It's a shift from seeing what's not there to seeing what is there fully.
Yeah. I love gratitude practice for that reason. Because there are all these blessings around us if we would just take the time to pause and recognize them, right? Of a wellspring of gratitude in the heart. Beautiful. Thank you. Do one more.
I could do one.
Hit your own.
My aspiration is to receive lamp transmission from Thich Nhat Hanh, OI community.
Say that one more time.
My aspiration is to receive Dharma transmission from the community of Palm Village.
Okay, beautiful.
And I'm registered for the MMTCP to accomplish, as a, one of the steps to accomplish that.
That's beautiful, yeah.
Thank you. I'll get back to the dishes.
Yeah, there's something about being with the monastics and feeling the power of their practice, whether it's the monastics of Plum Village or Venerable Analio just across the field here. Yeah. And what they transmit through just the power of their being and their presence and their commitment to living Dhamma, being available to Dhamma. Yeah. It's so beautiful that we want to live into these wholesome, beautiful qualities that you've all just named. A quiet mind, wanting to be kind moment by moment, more patience, and ready for death, available to Dhamma, gratitude and letting go of the wanting mind. Just the transmission from people who are receiving the transmission from people who have dedicated their lives to Dhamma, have put it at the center. So these aspirations, these longings, in my opinion, are what Gil Fronsdale calls a biological imperative to freedom. And this is what he said about this imperative. That somehow the depth, the core of what this Dhamma practice is about, it's not up to you. Something's going to be working through you. And it's nothing mystical. It's not like coming from outside. It's a potential, a possibility that lives in your own heart, the biological imperative for liberation. It's a potential, a possibility that lives in your own heart, the biological imperative for liberation. So we have this, like I said, it's just my opinion. And when I heard Gil say this, this was last November, I remember being in the hall and I heard him say this. It was like, I had known it, but hadn't articulated it to myself. And to hear him say it, my heart just resonated. It's like, oh yeah, that is true. So we have this deep biological imperative for freedom. But how do we live into this? How do we live into this impulse towards awakening, impulse to quieting the mind, more patience, being available to Dhamma? How do we live into this? So I was at a retreat where one of the teachers was summing up the practice. And they said that this practice is about learning to love no matter what. And I've shared this story with you before, and it keeps showing up in my talks because I was just so moved by her question, because I feel like it's a question of my own heart. Yeah, I think she asked it on behalf of anyone who's felt this biological imperative for freedom. And she turned, Joseph was the one who kind of dropped this into the field of this practice is about learning how to love no matter what. She raised her hand and she got called to speak and she said, that's a beautiful aspiration, but how do I live into that? And I think in her question, she was aware of the obstacles of living into our deepest our highest aspirations, our deepest longings. Because we are such kind of soft and vulnerable beings. And we have these eyes and ears and nose and tongue and these bodies and hearts that are so sensitive. And they are meant to know through attuning to and resonating with the world of sights and sounds and smells and tastes and thoughts and emotions and moods, our own and that of others. And if the world of our senses was all pleasure, was all pleasant, was all pleasing, this would be a heaven realm. And in fact, in this Buddhist cosmology that we've inherited, there are these realms that are just pleasant. And you can abide in them for eons and eons. But it's not Nibbana. The Buddha reminds us that they're impermanent. They are dukkha, in that they don't offer lasting satisfaction. They're not dukkha-dukkha, but they don't give the heart and mind the deep peace that it longs for. And we don't live, we don't inhabit those heaven realms. Like, this is a dukkha realm. And we know dukkha. We know the stress of pain, of sexism, of racism, of loss, of sorrow, of blame. And we know it because it hits us in our very sensitive and very soft bodies and nervous systems. And when we take the world in through our senses, sometimes it hurts. And when it hurts, there's this other biological imperative that shows up. And that's the imperative to avoid pain. And we do it in all kinds of ways. We bury our head in the sand. We brace the body. We live from the neck up. We overanalyze things. We try to push things away. We try to kind of will our way out of really painful situations. We want to avoid pain. And at the same time, we want to be free. The biological imperative to avoid pain and this biological imperative for freedom. And the tension between the two can feel so unbearable at times. And it can feel like they're at cross purposes with each other. And this for me was the kind of poignancy of this yogi's question. She was saying, I want to be free. But it's hard to be free considering everything a heart and mind and a body is susceptible to. It is hard to be free considering everything that a heart, mind, and a body will go through. As Stacy was reminding us, this body is going to die. It is going to fall apart and die. You're going to have to let go of our loved ones. Let go of our name and everything associated with our name. We want to be free, and it's hard to be free considering everything that we'll go through, like a global pandemic and political dysfunction. And like I said earlier, I know that some of us may be happy with the election results, some of us may not. But my friend was reminding me that wherever you stand on the results of the election, the country is still experiencing a kind of spiritual crisis, kind of made clear by how close this election was and how many people ended up voting for one candidate and the other candidate. But these imperatives don't actually need to be in opposition with each other. They can actually work in harmony. They can fuel each other through learning to love no matter what. Learning to love no matter what. It's our true nature. Again, my belief. And I feel like learning to love no matter what conditions we find ourselves in, it is the heart's nature. That it's a capacity of the heart that we can live into. And something that we can gradually grow into through care, through mindfulness, being very attentive, receptive, open, knowing presence. We can gradually live into this capacity to love no matter what through encouragement. And through not making an enemy of our reactivity. And our reactivity simply arises because we want to be safe. We want our loved ones to be safe. We want to be healthy. We want to come by the basic necessities of life with ease. We want to avoid pain. So our reactivity comes from Bryn Silver was reminding me of this, Matthew Bryn Silver, that our reactivity comes from a very innocent movement of the heart-mind. So in this year, which has been, who foresaw this? I didn't. I thought 2020 was going to be like, I just had all these plans for 2020. And not to say that wonderful things haven't happened, but it has been such a challenging year for me personally. And I think I know for all of us. And what has been a boon and a ballast for me has been the practice of compassion and equanimity. But what I've discovered is that before I can even live into genuine compassion and equanimity, I have to allow myself to have an honest encounter with my own reactivity. And this can feel so counterintuitive, especially when we're in touch with our aspirations. It's as if our aspirations and what we long to live into in terms of our practice and our life can get kind of hijacked by the superego that then uses it as a tool to berate us in some way. And there can be these places where we kind of hide out in the practice and we're not really having an honest encounter with our reactivity, because to do so feels like we're somehow that's evidence that we're not living into our aspiration, into our longings for practice. But this practice, as I said earlier, it's a gradual path. And our practice slowly wears away at our craving. It slowly wears away at our reactivity. And until we've completely uprooted greed, aversion, and delusion, we will go through cycles of reactivity, especially if we feel like we don't have the inner resources to actually meet the present moment, meet the challenges of the present moment. So we don't need to make an enemy of our reactivity. We don't need to do it because we recognize, one, that it's coming from this place of real innocence. There's an innocent impulse behind wanting to avoid pain. And out of that comes this reactivity. So we don't need to make an enemy of the reactivity. We see that it's coming from this really innocent place. In our reactivity, just by learning to relate to it in an intelligent way, learning to relate to it through and with mindfulness, it actually gets transformed into a gateway to all these beautiful aspirations that you named. More patience, getting ready for our death, gratitude. Our reactivity can actually become the means by which we cultivate really beautiful, wholesome qualities like mindfulness, energy, investigation, truthfulness. So it can propel us along the path towards our aspirations, towards freedom, towards awakening. And in my own practice, I found that before I can even arouse compassion for somebody else or meet my current circumstances with some measure of equanimity, that I actually have to have an honest, direct encounter with my own reactivity. And there have been three practices that have been really supportive in this. Patience, self-compassion. And using my imagination in moral, ethical ways that actually helps to grow and cultivate empathy, which I think on a collective level, we are so in need of right now. Things are so divisive. And I really loved that someone had said, you know, I want to let go of the wanting mind. We can get so caught up in wanting to be right and prove the other side wrong, instead of getting curious about, why do you hold that? What is it that you value? What is it that your heart longs for? What do we actually have in common? So when there is indignation and hatred in this heart and mind, and I've been testing it, I've been like, probably no surprise that I don't subscribe to what I see on Fox News, but I've been reading and going to their site lately and going to Breitbart News and reading it. And I feel there is this reactivity in my heart and mind. So when this heart and mind is filled with indignation or hatred directed at another person, I just bring in the practice. I'm like, okay. Sati. Yep, this is a heart and mind that is just filled with hatred. And can you just be with this heart and mind filled with this reactivity? And sometimes the heart's like, no. It's like, okay, I feel you. I get you. It's like, can I actually widen and deepen my capacity to actually be with the hatred and the aversion towards the hatred and just breathe right there? I'll need to make it go away. I'll need to pretend it's not there. I can just have an honest, direct encounter with the indignation, with the hatred and the aversion to it. And the breath is so supportive. It's like, just breathe right here. And the reason I'm using hatred as an example, and I'm going to continue to use hatred as an example, is again, we get so intense on our aspirations or our longings for practice that we sometimes don't want to admit to ourselves that afflictive emotions like despair or rage or hatred run through the nervous system, run through the heart and mind. But learning to be with aversion, learning to be with hatred, is the third establishment. It's a part of the third establishment of mindfulness. This is a part of our foundational, essential Satipatthana practice. This third establishment of mindfulness just entails knowing the currents, the moods, the thoughts, the emotions within the heart mind that fuel our actions and our words. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha describes how to actually practice with this third establishment of mindfulness when hate is present in the heart and mind. And I love the simplicity of this. He says, and how does one abide contemplating mind as mind? Here, one understands a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. And this is part of our birthright. He calls all four of these foundations, body, feeling tone, this heart mind, this third foundation, the dhammas, he calls them our, or it's translated as our ancestral domain. Gil Fronsdale He translates it as our native land. So usually our habitual relationship with body, feeling tone, thoughts and emotions and other mind states that are moving through the heart, mind, the dhammas, usually we're caught up in our ideas, our views, and our opinions. And the Buddha is saying, hey, not your ideas, not your wishes for, not the ways that you've been conditioned to relate to, say, your body. Just shift your attention to have an honest encounter with the ancestral domain of the body, of feeling tone, of the heart mind, of the dhammas. And when you do that, when we do this, we come into our inheritance, our birthright that was described, that is described so beautifully at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. And Buddha says, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas. So when I say being with our reactivity, learning to be with our hatred intelligently is a part of our birthright, I'm not being poetic. I'm not making this up. The Buddha was not messing around. Being with our reactivity is coming to our ancestral home, our just ancestral domain, our native land. Just knowing what's happening in the heart and mind while it's happening. This third establishment of mindfulness. Knowing a heart with hate passing through it. All supported by some measure of patience. So we're with the utter discomfort of hatred. We know it through attuning to it, to resonating with it, without letting it breach the boundaries of our heart and move into our words and our actions. And that's patience supporting equanimity. Now, with patience, we witness and bear, say, the pain of hatred, the intense discomfort of it, without causing harm. So we end up staying true to our commitment to not cause harm. So before the heart can genuinely rest in compassion and equanimity, we just call on patience. We call on patience to be with these afflictive mind states like hatred, like anger. And at some point, we're with these states and we feel the pain of it, what Philip calls the ouch of dukkha, the ouch of the pain inherent in the afflictive mind state. And that's when we can bring forth self-compassion for ourselves. And we can use the phrases. It's important that when we use the phrases that they don't become a rote exercise, that the phrases carry the energy that'll help us meet the afflictive mind state, that'll help us to meet the pain inherent in the afflictive mind state with some measure of tenderness. But some measure of tenderness that helps us alleviate the pain through simply witnessing the pain with warmth and with care. So we can also use Dr. Kristen Neff's self-compassion break. What I love about her self-compassion break is there's a part of it where you just acknowledge that challenges and difficulties are an inherent part of life. She says, she uses the phrase that, you know, this is just common to humanity. And there's this I've been reading a lot of Lucille Clifton lately. She's an African-American poet. She died in 2010. She was born in 1936. Six children, knew a lot of difficulty, knew a lot of pain. And when you hear her read her poetry, there's just such a human there, and she's so at ease in her skin. And she just knew about dukkha, but she wasn't destroyed by it at all. And there's a line of her poetry that I've been carrying around with me, because it reminds me of the inherent nature of those challenges of being human. She says, "No failure in us that we hurt like this. No failure in us that we can be hurt like this. No failure in us that we can be hurt like this." So to experience pain, to experience hardship, it's not a personal failing. It's just common to humanity. Common to just, not just humanity, but just being alive. And in acknowledging this, it connects us to our own pain. And through connecting with our own pain, we connect with the pain of others, right? Gets wider and bigger than us. So we have an honest encounter with our own reactivity. We summon patience so that we can just be with the pain inherent in the afflictive mind state without trying to pop out of it. Just have an honest encounter. We stay with it, bringing in self-compassion. And then if there's energy left, right? If there's some energy left, it actually makes sense to do so. And I find when there's hatred that's aimed at someone else, or there's resentment aimed at someone else, this last step is super helpful. So we summon empathy for those that we're resenting, that we're feeling some intense afflictive emotion towards. So by cultivating empathy, we're not condoning egregious behavior. We're not allowing someone to walk all over us. We're not allowing someone in our lives that has harmed us in the past and still has the capacity to actually hurt us. We're just simply coming to understand how they've come to where they are, which helps us in meeting them with some measure of compassion and equanimity, meeting ourselves with some measure of compassion and equanimity. So as you all know by now, I don't need to tell you, I love Lorraine Hansberry, one of my favorite playwrights. She wrote A Raisin in the Sun. And I want to share a moment from A Raisin in the Sun because it really, you'll see. But I want to just set up this scene for you so you have some context. So it's the early 1950s, late 1940s, early 1950s, sometime after World War II, south side of Chicago. And the Youngers, this Black family, is in crisis. The father of the family has died, and with his death has come this insurance check. It's about $10,000, $100,000 in today's currency. The matriarch of the family wants to move her family out of the south side of Chicago. So empathize with this because my grandmother wanted to move her family out of Marin City. So the matriarch of the family decides to put a down payment. She uses about a third of the insurance money to buy a house in a predominantly white neighborhood. And she is so concerned about her son, Walter Lee. He's just torn up on the inside because he so wants to live into this male archetype that I think men inherit from this culture of wanting to be a provider and a protector. And the conditions of late 1940s, early 1950s, emasculated African-American men. So he's in real pain and he has all these dreams that he just can't bring into fruition because of real legitimate obstacles. So he wants to buy a liquor store and his mama says, okay, here's the rest of the money. Here's the 2/3 of the money. It's about $66,000 in today's currency. She says, you take a third of that money, go ahead and buy your liquor store. That other third of the money, I want you to put that in a savings account for your sister, Benita, for her college, for her schooling, for her education, because she's planning on being a doctor. A really beautiful aspiration. So Walter Lee, mama's son, has this money and he decides that he's going to take all of it and invest it in a liquor store and gives it to his business partner, Willie Harris. But Willie Harris's nickname is Bobo. Now, would you trust somebody named Bobo with your money? There's something about people's nicknames that tells us about who they are. Now, Walter Lee goes ahead and trusts Willie Harris, Bobo, with his money. Bobo runs off with the money. In the meantime, Lindner, and we never learn his first name, is Lindner. He comes into the Younger household. He's a white man who's representing the neighbors who live in the neighborhood that the Youngers are about to move into. And he says, look, he makes them an offer and he says, we will pay you not to move in our neighborhood. You name the price and we will pay it. Just do not move into our neighborhood. We don't want you. So Walter Lee realizes that he can recoup the money by taking Lindner up on his offer. And as Walter Lee reveals his plan to do this he reveals his plan to recoup the money from Lindner, and he reveals it to his wife, Ruth, his mother, and his sister, Benita, or Benny. And he is so eaten up by internalized racism that he disintegrates before their eyes. And it is devastating for these women to see this. And it is devastating as an audience member to see it too. So I want to read you this passage from A Raisin in the Sun because it calls on the power of empathy and moral imagination in service of compassion and compassionate action. So Benny says, so Walter has just disintegrated before their eyes. He had been down on his knees. He gets up and he looks at his mama as if to say, I'm going to take this money and I will feel fine about it. And his last lines before he goes into the room is, and I'll feel fine, fine, fine. He goes into this room and he slams the door. And his little sister Benita says, that is not a man. That is nothing but a toothless rat. And his mama says, yes, death done come into this here house. Done come walking in my house on the lips of my children. You, what was supposed to be my beginning again. You, what was supposed to be my harvest. She looks at her daughter, Benny, and she says, you mourning your brother? And Benny says, he's no brother of mine. Mama says, "What'd you say?" And Vinny says, "I said that that individual in that room there is no brother of mine." And Mama says, "That's what I thought you said. You feeling like you better than he is today? Yeah? What you tell him a minute ago, that he wasn't a man? Yeah? You give him up for me? You done wrote his epitaph too, like the rest of the world? Well, who give you the privilege?" And Vinny says, "Will you be on my side for once? You saw what he did, Mama. You saw him down on his knees. Wasn't it you taught me to despise any man who would do that? Do what he's gonna do." And Mama says, "Yes, I taught you that, me and your daddy. But I thought I taught you something else. I thought I taught you to love him." And Vinny says, "Love him? There's nothing left to love. Do you hear what Vinny is doing? You see what she's doing? This is where we abandon each other in our reactivity. When we're filled with hatred and disgust for another person, we divest them of their full humanity. We can call them 3/5 of a human being, vermin, basket of deplorables. We, in our reactivity, we abandon each other, we reduce each other, and we stop loving each other. We forget our connection to each other. So Benny says, "Love him. There's nothing left to love." And Mama says, "There is always something left to love. And if you ain't learned that, you ain't learned nothing. Have you cried for that boy today? I don't mean for yourself and for the family because we lost the money. I mean for him, what he'd been through and what it done to him. Child, when do you think is the time to love somebody the most? When they done good and made things easy for everybody? Well, then you ain't through learning, because that ain't the time at all. It's when he's at his lowest and can't believe in himself because the world done whipped him so. When you start measuring somebody, measure him right, child, measure him right. Make sure you done take into account what hills and valleys he come through before he got to wherever he is. Can we use our imagination in ethical ways, in moral ways, to imagine another person's circumstances, to imagine their inner world? Can we dare to project ourselves into their conditions and feel from the inside what it's like to be them and how they came to make the choices that they made? How they've come to the words that they say. And again, it doesn't mean that we're condoning their behavior, especially if it's harmful. We're just cultivating an understanding of their suffering. And through understanding their suffering, we're learning to care for their suffering. And perhaps through learning to care for their suffering, there may be this genuine wish to alleviate their pain. And out of that genuine wish, there may be the impulse, the actual movement to alleviate their pain if we can, if we have the resources, if the circumstances are there that support us in mitigating their pain. And the Buddha called this anukampa, compassionate action. And this is what Mama does. So Lindner comes to the younger apartment, pay off the younger family so they don't move into his neighborhood. And Travis was 10 years old, walks into all of this. And Travis is about to witness his father, Walter, say to this white man, "We'll take your money and you can continue to treat us like second-class citizens because we ain't worth a damn." And Ruth, seeing that her son is about to witness his father sell his family and himself down the river She says, Travis, you go downstairs. And Mama says, no. She's talking to Travis, but her eyes are on Walter Lee. And she says, no. Travis, you stay right here. And you make him understand what you're doing, Walter Lee. You teach him good, like Walt Willie Harris taught you. You show where our five generations done come. Go ahead, son. She folds her hands, closes her eyes, and says, go ahead. This is genius in action. This is genius in action. In the face of internalized racism, Mama is fighting for her son, is fighting for her grandson, fighting for her daughter, fighting for her daughter-in-law, for her entire family through compassionate action. Just beseeching Benny, saying, don't forsake your brother. There's always something left to love. Just imagine his circumstances right now. And then appealing to Walter Lee through his love for his son, Travis, to do right by his family and not give in to the strong gravitational force of internalized racism. Now, this is a passage from an article written by Neil Burton, who's a British psychiatrist. He says, compassion is more engaged than simple empathy and is associated with an active desire to alleviate the suffering. With empathy, I share your emotions. With compassion, I not only share your emotions, but also elevate them into a universal and transcending experience. Compassion, which builds upon empathy. Compassion, which builds upon empathy, is one of the main motivators of altruism. And you see that in Mama's actions. She's saving her family. And it's an altruistic movement of the heart. But do you get a sense of how the biological imperative to avoid pain and the biological imperative for freedom, how they can be integrated, that they can work in concert with each other. When we metabolize our reactivity by calling on patience and self-compassion and empathy through using our imagination in moral and ethical ways. So we don't need to make an enemy of our reactivity, which I know is going to be arising for me in the days and couple of months, 3 months to come. That our apathy, our indifference, our hatred, maybe even despair, hopefulness, frustration can be a condition for living into our just these aspirations that you all named, more patience, wanting to be kind moment to moment, ready for our death, gratitude, letting go of the wanting mind, making ourselves available to Dhamma. That this reactivity can be the gateway towards our, towards awakening, gateway to freedom. Where we've run over, let's just sit in silence for a minute.